It's 7:43 on this West Virginia morning. I'm Teresa Wills. We're speaking with a police officer turned sociologist this morning. He offers a researcher's perspective on gun violence.
In places where people know each other, there's some level of cohesion, there's a willingness to intervene for the common good, there's low risk of crime, there's low risk of guns being listed as a problem, and drugs also.
We'll have that conversation coming up in just a few minutes. This is West Virginia Morning. Our weekend show, Inside Appalachia, considers some of the struggles communities dealing with oil and gas face. While the growth in horizontal gas drilling, fracking, has brought new energy sources and new economic development in some communities, it also brings new health concerns. In the Utica Shale region, some Ohio residents have taken it upon themselves to start a fracking health registry. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant reports.
A dozen people are scurrying around a church basement in Youngstown, Ohio. They're arranging tables and chairs, setting up paperwork, and hanging up signs that read Ohio Health Registry.
Well, the Ohio Health Registry is really an attempt to collect the contacts of people who live close enough to any aspect of shale development that they might be affected.
This is Dr. Deborah Cowden, who started this effort. She's a family physician near Dayton and drove 3.5 hours east this morning to organize the registration. Cowden's group created a series of forms that take about 15 minutes to fill out.
This is the medical questionnaire, and I'm going to read some instructions first.
They ask people about their proximity to gas development and about current health symptoms, everything from levels of fatigue, nausea, and asthma, to cancer, mental health, as well as family health history. 60-year-old Martin Sinjenik, a truck driver, filled out the registration forms. He's heard about a new frack waste injection well being permitted near his home.
I live less than a mile from what they're building there, and I'm worried about it.
Sinjenik doesn't think the state is ensuring his drinking water well will be protected from contamination, but he doesn't know how the health registry will help.
I'm not sure, to be honest with you. It might not do anything. I don't know.
More and more studies have been making connections between living near gas development and the risk of some health problems like headaches and anxiety, low birth weight babies, and even cancer. Cowden wants the health registry to provide data that will help further this kind of research as fracking continues to grow in the state.
If we're going to do this, why are we not attempting to keep track so that we might be able to help people if they have a problem?
Ohio regulators say they do respond to health concerns. Rebecca Fugit is Assistant Chief of the Bureau of Environmental Health and Radiation Protection at the Ohio Department of Health. Fugit says they just don't get many complaints from citizens about the fracking industry.
No, we only get maybe it's less than 5 a year. I mean, to be honest, it really is. We don't get very many.
The Ohio Department of Natural Resources, which regulates the oil and gas industry, also gets a few health complaints from people living near these operations. The Allegheny Front analyzed thousands of complaints by citizens to ODNR between 2009 and 2018 and found just 10 reporting headaches, rashes, and breathing problems. But ODNR did get more than 400 complaints about odors. Certain odors can indicate pollutants in the air. Fugit says the health department does respond to citizens who think pollution from oil and gas development or anything else is harming their health.
And we work with them on a case-by-case basis to investigate their complaint, to collect environmental data as needed to respond to their concerns and determine if they have been exposed to any contaminants.
Fugit says Ohio tracks various health statistics, just not specifically in relation to fracking activity. And Pennsylvania and Colorado do have registries for people living near the oil and gas industry to report their health concerns. But some health advocates say they're not doing enough.
I'll tell it like it is. I think it's shameful.
That's Raina Ripple. She runs the Southwest Pennsylvania Environmental Health Project. She wants the government to proactively collect community-wide health data on people in shale gas communities so it can better regulate the industry and protect public health. Her organization started a national health registry for fracking in 2017. An analysis of the first 100 to register found that people living within a quarter mile of gas development were more likely to report coughs, headaches, and anxiety compared with those a mile or more away. But she says this kind of data should be collected in a more systematic way.
I mean, we have to do our best, I'd say, to really fill in the gap. I think that this is really us, these small groups, these groups that don't have a lot of resources, doing the work that we know needs to be done. And hopefully the states and or the federal agencies will ultimately pick up the ball that they've dropped.
Marcellus Drilling News, an industry publication, criticized Ripple's project, writing that it encourages people to blame every headache and cough on gas development.
The medical questionnaire begins by asking about your past health.
Meanwhile, the Ohio group so far has 65 people on its registry, and with more registrations like this one in Youngstown, is hoping to reach 200 by the end of the year. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
That story was supported by the Fund for Investigative Journalism and the Sear Sweatland Family Foundation, and is part of the Allegheny Front series, Who's Listening? About Fracking in Ohio. You can hear that and more this weekend on Inside Appalachia, Sunday morning at 7 and Sunday evening at 6. In the wake of mass shootings, more public health officials are calling for gun violence to be treated as a public health concern. Carol Lofton spoke with West Virginia University sociology professor and former police officer James Nolan about how taking guns away or incarcerating more people might do little to actually make people safer. He argues reducing violence may be as simple as building stronger, more engaged communities. Here's part of that conversation.
When you hear the term gun violence as a public health concern, what does that mean to you?
Well, I mean, it shifts from a criminal justice matter to a public health matter. It focuses on outcomes, which is the harm that's caused by guns. The other interesting thing about shifting to a public health focus is that it enables us to think more about measuring outcomes rather than just the, you know, a number of things that people like the police and prosecutors do to curb gun violence. It's an outcome-focused and research-oriented discipline.
You know, in a place like West Virginia, there's a very particular sort of viewpoint around guns. There should not be gun control legislation, and that there people it's part of the basic right of being American. How do you sort of take these very polarizing, disparate views and create a society where guns aren't a public health hazard, essentially, where it's not a public health concern?
Well, I don't think there's a shortcut to dialogue and open discussion about these things. I mean, as you probably know, we've had this debate recently on the campus of WVU because there's been legislation introduced that would have open carry in the classrooms and in the dorms and that sort of thing. And we actually followed, our founding fathers' guidance. I mean, if you look at the minutes of the University of Virginia Board of Visitors meeting around the time of Madison and Jefferson, they voted no to guns on campus. And Madison, of course, was the primary author of the Second Amendment. So even, you know, our founding fathers and those who created the Second Amendment were logical about that there are places where guns should be allowed and not allowed. But only by exposing, you know, giving rise to a voice that exposes these realities can we ever, you know, really deal and have guns and still be safe.
I want to talk a little bit about this idea of dialogue, because there's been a lot of sort of coverage recently about the impact of social media on dialogue, because we end up having these sort of very narrow circles of news cycles that we see. So, you know, somebody who's liberal might see a more liberal news feed. Somebody who's conservative might see a more conservative feed. And there's not a lot of crossover. So when we are talking about an issue like gun control or gun safety, how do we facilitate those dialogues in a way that's productive, as opposed to people just sort of being reinforced whatever it is that they already believe?
What we have to adopt is an experimental mindset that we, together in dialogue, we develop working hypotheses that this or that policy may work, may help shape these public health outcomes. And we look at it and we measure it and we're honest about it. That it'll reach a point where people will come to the table and begin to talk about what what may work and how do we know that it works and how can we measure it and are we willing to try it for a while? The second part of this is, and we've done a study recently in West Virginia. We had a West Virginia phone survey that we've conducted over a two-year period where we asked people about their community and the relationships they have with each other and the police. And we find that in places where people know each other, there's some level of cohesion, there's a willingness to intervene for the common good. In these types of places, there's low risk of crime. There's low risk of violence. There's low risk of guns being listed as a problem and drugs also. But in places where there's conflict or alienation in the communities, in West Virginia, these places predict almost 100%, it's in the 90-some percent, that drugs are going to be a problem and guns are going to be a problem and crime is going to be a problem. And then there's a third type of place that people are not connected to each other. They don't know their neighbors, but they feel safe because they believe that the police can protect them. These places are also not very safe. So it's a dependence on the government, dependence on the police, dependent on the authority to protect the community, to shortcut the interactions that are necessary to make a community really strong, that work against safety. So we are working with a state agency to publish these findings. But I think they'll lead to a discussion that has us say, you know, whether it's drugs or guns or crime or whatever the issues are in West Virginia, the best type of a public safety response is not more protection, more people with guns, but dialogue so that we can work through these things together because we need to build the types of relationships that actually really can make places safer.
That was sociology professor James Nolan from West Virginia University, speaking with our health reporter, Carol Lofton. Appalachia Health News is a project of West Virginia Public Broadcasting with support from Charleston Area Medical Center and Marshall Health. Michael and Tanya Trotter are the driving forces behind the War and Treaty. With an energetic sound that blends classic roots, gospel, and R&B with country and soul, the duo is a treat to experience live. Our song of the week comes from the band's first appearance on Mountain Stage, their soulful gospel-influenced song, It's Not Over Yet.
Will your heart speak for no one but yourself? Have you lost all your faith in good health? Are you dying to live within yourself? Have you canceled out heaven just for help? I see your pain. You weary it on your sleep, mistake the rain. For the tears you cry will sleep. It's not over yet. You got more to live for. It's not over yet. Happiness is at your door. It's not over yet. Here's your unclouded day. It's not over yet for you and me. Is this message too hard to receive? Did that last blow steal all of your relief? Can I muss out your doubt into belief? Oh, I'll give you back your joy if you give me your grief. I see your pain. You wear it on your sleeve, mistake the rain. For the tears you cry will see, I know it's dark, oh, and the clouds on the line.
That was the Warren Treaty performing live on Mountain Stage. To hear this and more, tune in every Friday and Saturday night at 8 right here on West Virginia Public Broadcasting. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. You can keep up with the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. Support for our news bureaus comes from West Virginia University, Concord University, and Shepherd University. Our Appalachia Health News Project is made possible with support from CAMC and Marshall Health. West Virginia Morning is produced with help from Caitlin Tan, Jessica Lilly, Carol Lofton, Liz McCormick, Dave Mistich, Brittany Patterson, Eric Douglas, Corey Nollinger, Emily Allen, and Roxy Todd. Our news director is Jesse Wright. Our producer is Glennis Board. I'm Teresa Wills.